Well, good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Ian Larson. I'm Director of Public Affairs and Communications here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I would like to welcome you to today's book event on negotiating Arab-Israeli peace. This book is one of many that will be released by the USIP Press in 2008, and I think it's really a very important product. There's been quite a lot of excitement about this particular effort for many, many months here at the Institute. I remember very well when Scott Lisensky, one of the co-authors, came to me in the spring of last year, and he had this sort of excitement on his face telling me about this project that he was working on with the Institute study group on Arab-Israeli peacemaking. And he said, geez, you know, we're doing this analysis of U.S. involvement in the Arab-Israeli peacemaking process over the last several decades, and we're going to be interviewing pretty much everyone who's ever been involved in this process from the U.S. and other important countries. And I thought to myself, wow, that really sounds like a very important effort. And anytime anyone tells you about a project, you start to get the sense of its importance. But it wasn't until a few days later, when I was sitting at my desk here on the second floor of the Institute, and I looked up and saw Scott walking by with former CIA Director George Tenet, that I got a sense that, well, this actually really is something big that's going on. And a short time later, I walked into the front office of the Institute, and I happened to see Tenet sitting in the executive conference room in his shirt sleeves with his sleeves rolled up, and was really very engaged in this process. And then a little bit later that day, I saw Scott walking by my office again with Madeleine Albright, and I said, okay, I really believe you, Scott. This is truly an important project that you are working on. And it was in the fall of last year, just before the Annapolis meetings, that I finally had an opportunity to read the manuscript. And something struck me when I read that manuscript, and that was that while, in essence, you know, the Institute has produced a book, it's taken the form of a book, it really raises to a much higher level. This product really is a tool for policymakers, and I think that as many policy analyses come out of various organizations in this town and in other world capitals every year, there are very few that raise to the level that this one has. This is the kind of product that really should be on the tables of all of the presidential candidates this year, policymakers across the world, because it is much more than simply a history of U.S. involvement in the peace process, much more than simply an analysis, but it's a guidebook. It helps policymakers understand where they can go from here and what the pitfalls are, and really what's, I think, necessary in order to move the peace process forward. And so I think we at the Institute are really very, very proud of this effort and very proud of Ambassador Kurtzer and Dr. Lisensky for their leadership on it, because it is a spectacular example of the kinds of products that this Institute wants to produce year in and year out. We want to make sure that all of our products really at the end of the day are tools that can be used by policymakers across the world. And this one certainly rises to that level. Before I introduce our speakers, I'd like to ask you also to point out that, like all of our public events, we are recording today's event, and if you wouldn't mind turning off your cell phones, turning off your PDAs, any sort of wireless device you might have that could receive a signal, could interfere with our audio, and we want to make sure that we have crystal clear audio that you can listen to later if you so choose, and refer your friends and colleagues to as well. Without further ado, I will introduce our two speakers today, the co-authors of this report, Ambassador Dan Kurtzer and Dr. Scott Lisensky. Ambassador Kurtzer was U.S. Ambassador to Egypt under President Clinton and U.S. Ambassador to Israel under President George W. Bush. He is currently S. Daniel Abraham Chair in Middle East Policy Studies at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, and is a co-director of the Institute Study Group on Arab-Israeli Peacemaking. Scott Lisensky is currently Acting Vice President of USIP Center on Conflict Analysis and Prevention, and is a former fellow at the Brookings Institution and the Council on Foreign Relations. I'll introduce Ambassador Kurtzer first. Both gentlemen will have an opportunity to give us a sense of the kinds of information that is contained in this very important tool, and then we'll have a question and answer session after that. Thanks very much.
Good afternoon. Scott and I want to maximize the amount of time that we can have a conversation, so our remarks will be relatively brief, and it'll give a chance both to look at the current situation, but particularly the current situation against the backdrop of the study group in which we found that there were some lessons that could be imparted both to this administration and to the next administration on trying to guide the Middle East peace process toward more successful outcomes than have been achieved in the recent past. We've seen, and our study group found, that the peace process willy-nilly becomes a presidential issue, even if a president enters office intent upon it not intruding upon his or her administration. And every president in the past 20 to 30 years has, in one way or another, engaged in this process of attempting to reach a settlement between Arabs and Israelis. We've also seen presidents succeed and other presidents fail to succeed. And it's on the basis of looking at the differences between those elements which contributed to success and those which did not that we really centered this study. In fact, the study was generated as a result of, in one sense, as a result of one question. Our time frame started in the early 1990s, essentially after the Cold War, Madrid Peace Conference, during that period. And for those who remember that period, it was a time when there was an almost perfect coming together of circumstances that led many people to believe that comprehensive peace was more than the dream of a handful of American diplomats. You remember it was a time the Cold War had ended and Soviet-American rivalry in the Middle East turned, at least for a short period, into Soviet or Russian-American cooperation. It was a time when the United States, in forming an international coalition to repel Iraqi aggression against Kuwait, was able to bring into that coalition some of our major Arab friends and some Arab states that were not that friendly with us at the time, but who understood that it was necessary to make a choice with respect to aggression even among Arabs. It was also a time when the Palestinian Intifada had produced a generation of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who were not taking orders from Tunisia and who were taking decisions, in this case, to fight an intifada without reference to the PLO. And it was also a time at the end of 1991 when the Madrid Peace Conference was convened that broke quite a few taboos in the Middle East and produced a set of bilateral and multilateral negotiations which lasted for several years. And finally, it was a time in 1992 that witnessed political change both in Israel and in the United States. The United States, the election of Bill Clinton as president, taking over from George H.W. Bush, and in Israel, Yitzhak Rabin taking over from Yitzhak Shamir. And for those who had followed the process closely, one could give Shamir credit for having made the very distinctive and heroic decision to bring Israel to the Madrid Peace Conference. But one also was cognizant of the fact, which Shamir himself admitted later, that he really had no intention of negotiating over the future of the West Bank and Gaza. And into office came a leader, Yitzhak Rabin, who announced from the outset not only that he was interested in reaching an agreement with Palestinians, but also with Syrians, in other words, a comprehensive peace settlement. And so there were a number of factors that came together in the early 1990s that in fact, bred some confidence that the peace process would actually reach fruition. And yet, as we looked back when we convened this study group over the past 15 years, the real question was what went wrong? Why did the Palestinian track collapse in 2000 and it was replaced by a violent intifada? Why did the Syrian track collapse in 2000 and replaced by a period of now 7+ years of no dialogue, no confidence between the sides to try to reach an agreement. And so we started out with that question, looking at the American role. Our orientation was that it's clearly up to the parties in the Middle East to make peace. It's their conflict, it is their responsibility, and they are the ones who have the most at stake and for whom the national interest is highest in trying to reach an agreement. But it is also a high national interest of the United States. And in that regard, we heard, as Ian noted in the introduction, we heard from 100 current and former officials, mostly American, but also in the region, from Syrians, Jordanians, Palestinians, Egyptians, and Israelis, and Saudis, and others. We heard a consistent number of themes that Scott will describe in a bit more detail, the so-called 10 lessons, or when I show a PowerPoint, I show Charlton Heston coming down with the Ten Commandments. We're not as presumptuous as to suppose that's the case, but it happened that we came out with 10 lessons that we thought could, in fact, be imparted. In so doing, we also look back at some of the successes and failures of the three administrations during this time period, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush. And as you'll see in the volume, there is a bit of a report card that assesses the administrations not in a normative sense, but judged against the policy priority that each administration assigned to this issue. And we found in many respects that particularly the Clinton and Bush administrations, the current administration, fell far short of conducting their diplomacy in a manner that was designed to carry out the policies that they themselves had articulated. And you'll see as you read through this volume what we might learn from that as well. We were as surprised as probably many in the room that the volume was actually going to have some importance for this administration, because our working assumption was that the Bush administration, having in 2002 articulated its idea of what a settlement should look like, but having done so little since then to try to see through the ideas that were carried in President Bush's speech of 2002, our working assumption up until this past year was that the administration would simply see its way through until the next administration took over. But it turns out that the book will also have some importance for this administration. The Annapolis process launched by President Bush last summer, which saw an international conference take place in November, with goals that were quite substantial. The goals of Annapolis, as articulated by the leaders who met there, were number one, to reach a final status agreement, number two, to change behaviors on the ground, and number three, to see all of this happen within a very short time frame, hopefully within the year from Annapolis. We haven't seen much progress since Annapolis. It suggests that there may be lessons that still can be applied in U.S. diplomacy, as well as by the parties themselves. And some of those lessons are not only obvious, but carry great weight. One of those lessons that we include in our volume is the idea that the Middle East peace process, as I noted, is a national interest of the United States. And if it is, as we heard from so many former and current officials, then the United States, the President of the United States, must act as such and must empower an experienced and diverse team to carry through diplomacy in a very active and engaged manner. It means that the United States, as the third party, which is insisted upon by the parties in the region, must also become much more engaged in monitoring the commitments undertaken by the two sides, developing a system of accountability for dealing with violations of those commitments, and that there will be some consequence to those parties that fail to fulfill their commitments. Peace processes in which there have not been monitoring and accountability activities have often drowned as a result of the weight of the plaque that has decayed the process itself. And so these are some of the things that we thought we would be imparting to the next administration, but in fact we offer to this administration as well in its final 8 or 9 or 10 months as it tries to develop an outcome, a positive outcome from the Annapolis process. Scott, as I noted, is going to describe a little bit more of the process in which we engaged to give you a sense of what we hope will be not just a series of recommendations, but recommendations that carry some credibility by virtue of who was part of our study group and how we conducted our business. And he'll also talk about the recommendations themselves and give you a snapshot of the report card. Thank you again for coming this afternoon. I particularly want to thank those of you who were my own mentors, and I include Michael Sterner in this over the years. He takes no responsibility, you know that line, he takes no responsibility for our errors. But if there's anything intelligent that we did say, it's from very heroic figures of our past 30 years in diplomacy that we can derive both the lessons of how to proceed in the future and have some confidence that we can actually succeed. Thank you so much.
Ian described me as being full of glee and excitement about a year ago, and naturally I woke up this morning with the world's worst cold, so my simple request to those in the front row, or Dan, if I fall down and collapse in the next 10 minutes, please pick me up. Let me say a little bit about what we did and who we got involved in the project and how the whole operation ran, a little bit about the report card. It's like we're all back in school, and then a little bit about the lessons going forward. The book is divided about equally, not so much, but it's very much an appraisal looking backward, but with the intention to look forward. We don't have a conclusion, you'll see, that suggests that somehow our best days as a mediator are behind us. We think there's a lot the U.S. can accomplish, and we're trying to point out the rules of the road for those who will follow. A little bit about the study group. We had what Dan likes to describe as a dream team of some of the leading thinkers on this issue, William Quant, Steven Spiegel, Shibley Telhami, teachers, activists, Track 2 negotiators, some with government experience, three of the people who probably spend more time on airplanes. Maybe Dan wins the prize. But we all got them in the room. We spoke to about 100 people from inside government, from outside government, and I have to tell you, as someone as ever so slightly younger than the four other members of the study group, it was quite remarkable to be in a room to conduct these interviews, over 100, and to see four people who've devoted 20, 30-odd years of their careers getting excited and learning a lot through our process. We had intensive consultations. We came up with a trove of information, 700 pages of transcripts, so much information we're expecting a second volume, less of a user's guide to Arab-Israeli diplomacy and more of a narrative. Everybody likes a narrative. There'll be more quotes and things like that. That's the people and the process. Let me say a little bit about the report card. I'll give you a condensed version. First, President Bush, we use the shorthand Bush 41, Bush 43. President Bush, Bush 41, comes out with the highest marks. Only one term in office, but yet this administration, and some of what I'm going to say is reflective of their foreign policy writ large, but it certainly showed its face on the Arab-Israeli issue. They came in with a clear strategy in terms of goals and how we'd get there. It was a disciplined, diverse, which is critical, and an experienced team, a team that argued. Dan was involved during much of this period. A team where out of a ferment came a very sound policy. The Secretary of State, Jim Baker, served as an envoy. In the book, we're neutral. We come out, you know, secretaries don't have to be an envoy. We have a whole chapter on how envoys should be used. But in this case, the Secretary himself was the envoy, and that was a very effective model. They consulted, this administration consulted with all the parties, often intensively, but our policy was sort of homemade, was always seen as such. And most importantly, this was a team that exploited opportunities, tried to create some when nothing was moving, but exploited when there were shifts in the strategic environment. And certainly, and most of you in the room know the story, to see often, excuse me, in this case, before the U.S. victory in the first Persian Gulf War, to see in advance that a strategic shift was over the horizon, and to plan accordingly, and to launch a process that really is a sort of a textbook success in American diplomacy. Some flaws, I'll only mention one here, a clear misjudgment on the importance of building a domestic coalition for peacemaking here in this country, something that left a bitter tail and affected our diplomacy in years later. We can talk about that more later. The Clinton administration, here are two terms in office. At the beginning, a strategic environment, as Dan said, that was really full of promise and possibilities. Here the record is mixed. It's a mixed record, decidedly mixed. Maybe this is what's somewhat new about our work, what we've done. On the positive side, and it's important to talk about the achievements of the Clinton years, first and foremost, there was a clear and unambiguous commitment that the U.S. was focused, engaged in the problem. It wasn't just understood in terms of perceptions and optics, but leaders in the region knew it. One former cabinet official told us in one of the interviews, and the quotes in the book, when I would be in the room with Arab leaders working on other issues that affected American national interests in the region, our commitment on the Arab-Israeli process opened all kinds of doors. The commitment was clear. They built a tremendous coalition at home here in the U.S. They built a coalition. They gathered domestic support for our efforts. And at a time when the congressional executive dynamic wasn't always pretty, if you know this period after 1994. The president, here I'll start to talk about some of the, I've told someone in the book, when it comes to the Clinton administration, there's dimples and there's warts. So I mentioned some of the dimples. Here's some of the warts. The role of the president, almost a textbook example of how damaging it can be for a president to be under-involved early on and then later to be over-involved. Early on, the president wasn't fixated on the issue. He was there at a few moments, signing ceremonies, sometimes a little bridging when an agreement needed to be signed, but generally was unengaged and was seen as unengaged in the process. Tasked down. Later, particularly in those last fateful 18 months of the administration, you see a president, and this is not a surprise to anyone in this room, who's over-involved. What we get in our interviews, and what you'll see in the book, is a little more texture, some more juicy quotes and details than maybe the other narratives have given you. But you have a president who's far too over-involved. Some leaders in the region essentially have walk-in rights to the Oval Office in ways that that devalued what a president is, sort of our last card in our diplomatic deck. Parties' bad behavior was often allowed to continue without serious consequences. There was a neglect, and you hear a very a very damaging neglect of the multilateral track. And here, one of the principal incentives for Israel, not just for the Israeli public, but for the Israeli leadership at the time, to get involved in a process that would bring them into the region, and the regional process withered in this period. And last, and here, if this was a sort of Shakespearean story, the focus, again, on particular moments, and in terms of our diplomatic toolbox, you see symmetry, just one of the many tools in our toolbox, But the very tool of summit meetings abused and misused. Geneva, Switzerland, early 2000, a meeting with Syria, not properly planned. The details are in the book and the discussions in the book, but it's really a how-to manual, how not to use a summit meeting. And then later, the Camp David story, better known to others. But we have some anecdotes, some quotes in the book. I'll tell one here. We were told by more than one official, there were a lot of issues on the table. I think some of you here know. I could do the laundry list. What was talked about at Camp David? Issues of borders, security, Jerusalem, refugees. We were told that on the American team, there wasn't a single official who was knowledgeable and had detailed understanding of the Arab position, Palestinian, and the wider Arab position on Jerusalem. How can you go into a negotiation like that lacking preparation? Bush 43 here, the last two terms, U.S. diplomacy. Here we give the lowest marks in terms of this issue. First and foremost, the lack of a sense of strategic purpose. How important is this issue, and what are we going to accomplish? Here's something that was quite visible in the first term: disagreement among senior officials. A lot of people in Washington refer to American foreign policy as often being run, you can count it on one hand, five people or less. You have those five people, strong disagreements. You have leading American officials in the region, for example, early 2002, trying to broker a ceasefire, and then having their knees cut off in the middle of a mission. Envoys unsupported, a policy process that, in the case, another anecdote from the book, the Bush-Sharon exchange of letters, early 2004, with the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza over the horizon the following year, you have a back channel being used, and a policy process that was created and sustained by an administration that, as we were told again by insiders, paid too high of a price in terms of American interests on this one issue. Much more could have been accomplished in that particular episode. Little interest in here. Such a dramatic contrast with the first Bush administration. A disinterest, it appears, in exploiting opportunities as they would be created. One example, if Arafat is the problem, and the administration was very clear about it, why not use the moment of his death, his passing, to try to reshuffle the deck? And there were other missed opportunities. The 10 lessons, as I was told by one of my colleagues, said, don't give them all away. No one's going to want to buy the book. I'll condense it a little bit. The first one, and you know, it sounds kind of dumb, like Arab Israeli diplomacy for idiots, but you have to go into it, and to echo what Dan said, you have to go into it with a sense that it's part of the U.S. national interest. The parties have their own interests. The parties have deep interests, deeply rooted interests. But you can't discount why it's important to the United States for what we've invested in the past, and for how it affects our other interests in the region. Former American envoy Dennis Ross has said repeatedly, this is one of the single most evocative issues in the region. You can't deny it. You have to have a sense of why it's important, and you also have to make sure the president's communicating that. These are parties, for better or for worse, probably for worse, but you can't change it. These are parties. This is a setting where American presidential engagement is expected. They've been spoiled. And they look very carefully at what presidents do and what presidents say early on in an administration, so you have to be very clear in terms of what you're setting out to be. The question of monitoring and accountability, has it been internalized by the Bush administration? Possibly. The president declares in Annapolis just a few months ago, the U.S. will be the judge. We will judge how each party stands up to their commitments. And here, one of the most universal conclusions that we got from all the interviews here in the U.S. and with people in the region, that you really need the U.S. not just to facilitate, not just to offer bridging proposals when they're needed, but to monitor and to hold the parties account. Because the minute you walk away from the signing ceremonies, there's so much backsliding. It's incredibly damaging. And they look to us. They often look to us to monitor the action of the other sides, and that's something we have to point out. That's something we have to work on our own. Has the Bush administration figure out how to do it? Well, it doesn't seem they have just yet, but I think you have to acknowledge and applaud the commitment to put the U.S. on the line in that. In that role. And then last, I'll mention there's actually two of the 10 lessons focus on both very inside the beltway, how you build a policy process. You have expertise, functional in terms of legal and economic and security interests, and you need expertise on Arab and Israeli politics. You need it equally. And you have to use what we often use, our shorthand name, you have to use the diplomatic toolbox in an effective way. Just one example. And here, here's an anecdote from a Palestinian leader who we interviewed. The way that we dealt with our foreign aid policy in the 1990s, when the Palestinian Authority was being created from the ground up, there was never clear conditionality. We often sold out questions of institution building and governance for progress in the negotiations. And when the negotiations stopped, the Palestinians were bereft with institutions that were dysfunctional. And we need to strike a balance. Some would say in the last few years there's been far too much movement in the other direction, institution building for institution building's sake, but you certainly need a balance. And our foreign aid is a tool that we should spend how we decide to, not an entitlement for any of the parties. It wouldn't be a book launch event if I didn't say something about if you will allow me something very quickly about a whole bunch of people here at the Institute of Peace helped us in publishing this book in. What I still think is record time. Our publication staff and our editors here, our publisher, Valerie Norville, and people in our public affairs, interviewing 100 people in 7 countries, maybe 8, involved all kinds of logistics. Our finance department and our congressional affairs department. We talked to a lot of people in the Senate and the House. So a big round of thanks across the Institute. We've got plenty of time left, 50 minutes. I think we're ready to take questions. You could throw. If you throw eggs, at least throw a lozenge or two. That's what I could use. Thank you.
We do have a microphone up here at the front. If any of you would like to ask questions, as Scott says, we have plenty of time. If you could take the time to queue up at the microphone at the front, please.
I'm Michael Sterner. Thanks, Dan, very much for the compliment. Certainly reciprocated. Among the policy dilemmas that all new administrations have to face is the question of the approach to take in negotiations in very broad terms. Do you try for an incremental, what we might call an incremental approach, confidence-building measures, limited agreements, never from the point of view of the United States as negotiator, getting too far out ahead of either of the parties? and backing off, as we have so often in the past, if there's an objection, a strong objection in that way of proceeding. Or on the other hand, the kind of approach that the Clinton administration finally came to, which was to take a plunge, in a sense Carter, of course, before him, take a plunge and go for the whole works. Start out, let's say, by saying we call on the parties to start at the point that they left off at Taba. Good progress was made. Some plausible proposals were put forward by the president in the White House before that. And let's cut out all this preliminary stuff and go to the heart of the matter. And I wonder if the two of you, in the course of all these discussions, developed a feeling or a view that one or the other would be the better way to proceed. Of course, much depends on the condition of the Israeli and Palestinian leadership, but let's just say for the sake of argument that it remains about the same as we have today.
The answer is most definitively. We heard time and again from so many of our interlocutors that the moment of incrementalism in this process had passed. While it had its day, and the theory behind incrementalism or reaching interim agreements was predicated on the idea that if the parties could reach those agreements and implement them, it would build confidence to then take on the tough issues. In fact, the history had suggested that the failure to either reach those agreements or to implement them properly was leading to a destruction of trust between the parties rather than the building up of trust. And so we do quite affirmatively recommend that an approach by the president be toward an end of conflict policy. Now, in that regard, we expressed some wonderment at the decision of the Clinton administration, which, having finally decided to put forward the so-called parameters at the 11th hour of the administration, then took those parameters off the table formally, leaving, in a sense, no legacy behind. It's not for no reason that the parties themselves, having not quite adopted the parameters the way the president wanted them to, nonetheless took them and negotiated on them at Taba just a month and a half later. So we do analyze this quite closely, and in fact in a footnote suggests that there may be far more agreement on the contours of a settlement than all of us have been willing to recognize until now. And if that's the case, it would give the pursuit of that kind of a peace process a little bit of a jump start for the next administration.
There was, if I could just say briefly, there's a debate in Washington about this, but it was clear from all the interviews we did, like Dan said, it was a consensus judgment among all five of us that the time for incremental solutions, you may need incremental ways to actually get to what you've pointed out and identified as the goal, but the time for step-by-step diplomacy is past, not just with Israelis and Palestinians, but with Syria and Israel. It would be quite helpful, obviously done right, and very clarifying for the U.S. to lean a little bit more forward on this. It'd have tremendous benefit, we believe, in terms of domestic politics in the region, where there's a hunger for a solution, and to understand exactly what the destination of the roadmap is, to sort of use some language from this process.
First, I wanted to congratulate both of you for putting this project together and publishing the book. I just wish that it would have come many years prior to that. I remember raising the issue with Ray Klein in 1969, and he said there was no interest in the State Department in getting deeply involved or supporting a dialogue between Israeli and Palestinians. And this was one missed opportunity, but there were several others. The first one was probably right after the War of Independence. that ended up with a ceasefire, and there was no follow-through on the part of the U.S. or part of Israel, for that matter. Again, in 67, when General Dayan called Hussein and offered him to find a solution, and Hussein did not show enough interest, and he just stopped there. In 69, I talked to Dayan, and he asked me to talk to Ray Klein, and there was a great deal of interest among the leaders of IDF and others in government to negotiate with the Palestinians. Unfortunately, that was missed. I think that as time goes on, it's getting to be much more difficult because the generation that has lived and worked with the Palestinians and had a lot of good experiences of living and working together is disappearing. The new generation...
If I could just suggest... Sorry, I mean, I think you're right. And we talk in the book, it's getting more difficult over time, but we haven't passed the point of no return. It was a clear outcome, not just in terms of what we heard from people in the region, but our own judgment. And there's a lot of people out there hounding on this question of, well, it's too late, and we've passed the point of no return. Time is ticking, which mm-hmm. adds to the urgency of the kind of proposal that we have in the book.
Well, two things. First of all, there is sort of a bitter taste left in Israel from the experience of dealing with Carter, in spite of the fact that most agree that the agreement with Egypt was something that should have been done. I think what happens in the Palestinian society is that the generation that is growing up now is growing up with hatred from elementary school or kindergarten on, and that's why it's getting to be more difficult and will continue to be more difficult. The same is true with the experiences that Israel has had with the Palestinians, and the new generation is much less willing to live with wishful thinking.
I'd only add one comment. The focus of this study is on U.S. behavior, and I think, Sai, what you were talking about was attitudinal change and perhaps even in a negative direction in the region, and that has to be of concern to U.S. policymakers. But one of the points that we do make that we've heard time and time again as well is the idea that opportunities don't always present themselves. Very often you have to create an opportunity. Certainly if an opportunity presents itself, you have to be agile enough to exploit it and to do something with it. And in this regard, we have not been as agile even when opportunities are out there, let alone we haven't been as creative as we can be in creating conditions which can lead to an opportunity for a breakthrough. And we cover this in some detail in the book.
I think you mentioned the Madrid conference as a new start for a peace process. But did the Madrid conference also take the United Nations out of the process, in which the Palestinians had quite a bit backing, and also there was a legal aspect that the United Nations could cover, and establish peace negotiations, which were a little asymmetrical? You had a very strong, relatively strong party, which had the upper hand against a weaker party. And didn't that lead to predictable stalemate in negotiations, which has happened today?
Yeah. Okay. I think what we've just been advised, we'll take two or three at a time, but then we'll get to that one.
And if I could, I'm sorry to interrupt, if I could have all of you introduce yourselves and any organizational affiliation that you might have as well.
Alan Brown from the Canadian Embassy. I was just wondering, I was thinking about your question, your response to whether incremental approaches work as opposed to the sort of more taking the plunge as it is work. And I'd like your assessment of the current approach that seems to be underway in Annapolis, of trying to get to an agreement that becomes a kind of on-the-shelf virtual agreement that's dependent on implementation of the roadmap for its ultimate success, and how you think the prospects of that look. Thank you.
Hi, John Marks from Search for Common Ground. A strong case can be made that the publics on neither side were ever prepared for peace. And I've heard Dennis Ross say very strongly that one of the biggest mistakes he made, and I think he made a few, was not after the Oslo Agreement, putting substantial resources and taking seriously the idea of track two diplomacy, of people-to-people diplomacy, of bringing people together. I mean, Seeds of Peace had 200 kids. If it had had 20,000 kids, maybe it would have started to have a real impact. And it's a wonderful kind of program, but there was never serious attention by the State Department or even USAID on these kinds of things. And this is something we talked about when you interviewed me, and I wondered if you could comment on that part.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead?
My question is related to this.
Actually, if we could wait, I'm sorry, if we could wait and
okay,
answer those first three,
we'll
and then we'll go into a second,
two
a next round of questions.
Yeah. They're great questions, and in fact, you'll be happy, those who ask the questions, to see much of what you've said reflected in the book. And it means you're a good audience, because you've anticipated what we've already written. On the question of the asymmetrical nature of the negotiations following Madrid, we in fact identify these asymmetries as one of the issues which the United States needs to address. And one of the ways we deal with this is to make the classic argument that on issues of security, it has become expected that the United States will tilt toward Israel and its requirements, whereas on issues of political rights, question of an independent Palestinian state, the United States must tilt towards the Palestinians. And one way to deal with the asymmetry of goals or of issues that underpin negotiations. But there are other asymmetries as well. And in this respect, better use of our diplomatic toolbox can help deal with some of these. We note in the volume that this is the only case that we know of where an occupying power is negotiating with a people under occupation in order to create the conditions for the independent state to emerge of those people, but it has to be reached by agreement. And it's a doable proposition, but it tells you that the built-in asymmetries there need to be addressed by the United States. I'd note on the second point, on the question of whether the shelf agreement that's currently seems to underpin the strategy of the administration can work. We don't take a specific position on this issue. We're trying to think more broadly about what the U.S. can do. But as Scott noted earlier, even if you're not following an incremental approach toward reaching the end goal, you may require an incremental approach in implementation. And it seems that the administration is leaning in that direction, understanding that while it may be possible for the leadership of the two societies to find a way to bridge differences, they then have to manage internal politics, which are quite a problem in both societies, and therefore it may take some time and some phases of implementation. I personally am uncomfortable with calling it a shelf agreement, because it sounds like you put it in the library and maybe it gets checked out later on. I would hope that what we're talking about is an agreement that's reached between the two political systems, and then there are phases of implementation that can help build that confidence that the two sides need to continue on. Do you want to do the third question?
And we have a section towards the end of the book on what we call sort of non-traditional diplomacy. We gather a lot of things under one heading, but people-to-people programs, because the societies need to engage, is obviously critical, and we've learned, and it's kind of a consensus judgment. It's hard to find people in Washington or elsewhere that disagree with you, but what it requires is an investment, and it's been underfunded. we have a lot of money sloshing around in this conflict, and it's not that hard to find, even if the ratio is 100-1, to fund this stuff. But Track 2 and other types of non-traditional diplomacy are important for other reasons as well. There are parties in this conflict we don't know a lot about. There are emerging leaders, even in countries that we know a lot about. And it's just absolutely critical not just to get out of the Beltway, but to get people out of the State Department, out of Foggy Bottom. And sometimes this is things that our partners do. Sometimes it's people out of government. But and here maybe there's a bias because we have people involved in our study group who believe fervently in this. But Dan, I think, and we lean on him a little on this, he can attest as someone who's a career diplomat who really spent so many years of his career in the building in Foggy Bottom and out in U.S. embassies that there's a lot more to learn, and you got to invest in, again, what we call non-traditional diplomacy in all of its variations. There's a lot of things, important things in that rubric. You need top down and you need bottom up. There's a critical quandary, to some extent, people inside the room can't dictate what's happening out, between societies, and you have to be careful on what you're measuring in terms of progress, issues of incitement, or whatever your metrics are. You got to be careful. There's only so much you can do, but at a minimum, you should be listening. At a minimum, you should be investing. And at a minimum, you should be paying attention, and your metrics should be about what's happening in the room and what's happening outside the room as well.
Okay, we'll take another round of questions, and if you could please introduce yourself.
Paul Sham from the Middle East Institute, currently, but during the virtually all of the process, like John, I was working on Track 2 and grassroots and cooperation of various sorts, both in this country and in the region. And one of the points I was going to ask about, you do talk about the role of grassroots, or the importance, shall we say. I guess my experience has both convinced me of the importance, but also that there is a tremendous amount that it doesn't cover. That the number of people involved was not limited just by the amount of money we had, which was limited, but the issues of language, the issues of how, you're talking about a population of millions, and so I guess on one level I'm skeptical about how grassroots organizations can affect the whole society. Therefore, I wonder if you could spell out a little, not just helping them, but how what you would have in mind, what lessons might have been learned, what should and shouldn't be done. A related question, what I'm working on is the narratives of the two sides, and I wonder if you deal with how or whether diplomacy can deal with these. And there's a debate going on whether the narrative should be left out or brought in. They're too hot to handle. On the other hand, are they too hot not to handle? Can you have a process without it? Finally, and very briefly, there's a...
You should be a White House correspondent.
No, I don't, thanks. But given the current non-truce that seemed to be going for a few days and now has disappeared, do you deal with processes of establishing legitimacy or semi-legitimacy for new forces? Obviously, I'm talking about Hamas, for whom the legitimacy is dealing with in a third party is deeply questioned by Israel and the United States. On the other hand, we have a new party here. Is this is there something in your book that gives us lessons for that? Thanks.
Let's take one more, and then we'll go into the answers.
I'm going to be very brief because the previous questioner just touched on something that I was going to ask. My name is Johanna Silverthorne. I'm from the Monterey Institute of International Studies, a graduate student. I wanted to ask about representation at these negotiations, precisely Hamas being one of the issues. International Crisis Group was very critical last fall of the process, which appeared to be isolating Hamas. And I wondered about that as well as when I was there last summer, Israelis as well as Palestinians often complained to me that they felt like the people who were actually being representatives of them weren't representative of their views. So this is actually both sides, although differently. So Israelis I spoke with felt that their government wasn't necessarily, let me make this clear, some Israelis I spoke with felt that their government wasn't necessarily truly representing them, and the Palestinians frequently complained that there was only one group that was considered the representative. And I just wondered if you could comment on that, please.
Paul asked about 11 questions. I'll try to grapple. Well, there were three with subcategories. We are not as skeptical as you suggested that you might be about the value of the range of whatever you call it, track two, people to people, non-formal, and there's a whole range of these that we touch upon in fairly short form. But we recognize that there are differences among these various manifestations of non-official activities. And while none of them can replace a formal agreement that's reached between the sides, each can contribute in its own way. So you have, for example, possibility of dealing with issues that require specialized expertise that may exist in governments but may not exist in a form that's easy for the two governments to bring together. So when you have a Middle East Cancer Consortium that comes together, all of a sudden the specialists have their own vocabulary anyway, and they can find ways of breaking down barriers that people in government might not be able to overcome. And you have other examples in the health field and in other fields as well. A second issue, it was mentioned earlier by John, is affecting the attitudes of the next generation through the summer camps idea or through exposing those who have been involved in the conflict to the needs of the other side. There's an NGO now in Israel and Palestine which focuses on the families of the victims of terrorism and counterterrorism. And they have found a way to talk to each other in a manner that governments simply can't do, and that helps as it moves out into the society. A third way we saw in Oslo is exploring ideas outside of negotiations that then come into negotiations. And one of the interesting things about the Oslo process is that if you had asked people at the time who knew about the process what was supposed to emerge, the thinking was that Oslo was going to inform the formal track. In fact, it was the formal track that informed Oslo, and Oslo became the formal track when it was legitimized. So does any of these solve a problem? No, but each one can contribute in a specific way. I'll come back to the question of narratives, and let me deal with Hamas because it was also the second question. We don't specifically in this volume take a position on the whether or not question with Hamas. But we do note that the history of U.S. policy with regard to dialogue with groups outside the process has often led to a hardening of a U.S. position when that may not have been the initial intention. In other words, U.S. views become conditions, become preconditions, and then become legislated in a form which is very hard to ever undo. We don't go into this, but what was informing our thinking and those of the people with whom we spoke was the idea that in the 1970s, the U.S. didn't want to do a formal dialogue with the PLO, but there were channels of communication with the PLO, which progressively got closed off as the conditions hardened and as the laws began to limit U.S. possibilities. And our advice, which again is not specific to Hamas, the Hamas issue, is that the U.S. retain whatever kind of options that it can, consistent with the views that it may have about a particular group. It's fair to argue not to talk to Hamas. It's fair to argue to talk to Hamas. What we advise against is allowing either of those views to go off on an angle that then becomes an inhibitor for U.S. diplomacy in the subsequent period.
There's a lot on the table. I would say something. We again, as Dan said, we don't touch on it in great depth, but on the Hamas question, on the larger question of rejectionists, larger question of dealing with states that we have troubled, sometimes adversarial relations. You want a situation, and I think there are plenty of examples in the past 20 years or so to see. You want the U.S. position. You want our script, and you want our conditions to be dynamic, not frozen. You want them to change over time and be used. We should certainly stick to our guns and our conditions, but you want it dynamic. You know, someone told me yesterday, they see the region, there's rejectionists, Iran, Syria, Hamas, Hezbollah, tremendous sort of alliance aligned against our Arab-Israeli peace project and everything else. Well, why make it so easy for them? There's all kinds of cleavages within that set of relationships that I think you can serve, and even you don't always accomplish it, and the Schultz PLO dialogue experience shows you that sometimes you can do it right, but the advances can be fleeting. But again, our policy should be dynamic. Our script should be updated here, because I'm from California, I'll use the Hollywood metaphor. The script should be constantly attuned. On the question of narratives, Dan and I haven't talked a lot about it. Maybe we disagree, but you know, it's not our job to square the narratives. I think they need to square it. It would help if they did it now. They'll probably get to it in a post-conflict situation. The Institute's done a lot of work on that. I think we need to expect of our own officials and our own leaders that we get the American narrative correct. That's important. Someone, a leading administration official from the Clinton years, stood here in this room a few years ago and described it as a Rashomon-type situation. You've got everybody telling different stories. So we need to get our narrative straight. And partly that's what we try to do. It's not a narrative book. It's a how-to manual. But I think we've started along that route. On some of the grassroots issues, I'll just mention one thing. And here, this is it's an arena where the Institute's been active, because we're not just a think tank and we're an operational NGO and we're doing funding. We're investing a lot of money in this question of Track 2 and its impact, especially on the social-to-social level. It's important, but you don't just fund it and support it and invest in it in a willy-nilly way. You've got to be careful. Some of the asymmetries we talked about in the negotiating room get played out in the realm of society-to-society interaction. So you have to be careful. Sometimes non-traditional diplomacy can make matters worse, so that's something we treat to some extent. It's not the focus of the book. Maybe I'll leave it at that.
The next two questions, please.
Hi, my name is Corey Julie. I'm a graduate student in the Department of Government at Georgetown. I was wondering if you could speak to the issue of domestic constraints, not just going beyond Hamas, but also broader domestic constraints within Palestine and within Israel. Even, I mean, you have a dwindling coalition in Israel, dwindling support for Olmert in the aftermath of Lebanon, and you have all these kind of factional infighting between Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. So how does the U.S. support engagement, and what's the potential for sustained engagement in light of these domestic constraints? And maybe you could speak of that sort of, in the background, keeping in mind Annapolis. Does it make sense for the U.S. to sort of initiate such comprehensive engagement at a time when domestic constraints in both Palestine and Israel seem to be on the high? Thank you.
My name is Ali Garib. I'm from Interpress Service, and this is sort of a follow-up of the same questions about what you just answered about adversarial governments and Hamas. But if you could speak to dealing with the issue of the legitimacy of Fatah in regards to Hamas being a democratic majority, and also about the importance of regional neighbors, and if that's something that's possible, looks like maybe not under this administration, but particularly for future administrations, for countries like Saudi Arabia and Syria and Iran.
Let me address the question of domestic constraints in two ways. One, we don't deal with the domestic constraints of the parties in the region in this book. We do deal with domestic issues in the United States, because our policy also operates within a domestic political environment. And as Scott noted in the brief report card overview that he gave you, different administrations handled the building of a domestic base for our policy to rest on, handled it quite differently, and that contributed to success or to the lack of success. So that's the formal answer within the context of the book. Let me take off my book hat for a moment and give you now a personal view. which is outside the purview of the book, and just suggests that there are several different ways to deal with domestic politics in the region. We normally like to leave it to the parties themselves to figure out how to do with it. What's interesting in this case is that, at least in words so far, the Israeli and Palestinian leadership has said that one methodology they're going to use to deal with their domestic constraint is to try to reach an agreement that will tell the two societies that there is hope for peace. Ehud Olmert sees an agreement as a fulfillment of the platform on which he ran successfully as prime minister, and Mahmoud Abbas probably sees an agreement as maybe the only way of putting before the Palestinian people a position which will either bring Hamas on board or lead to a further splitting of the society, but a split that effectively would be on the basis of a peace platform that Abbas had had been instrumental in constructing. So rather than see these domestic constraints right now as necessary hurdles to peace, the two leaders, at least at Annapolis, said that they are prepared to use the peace process to overcome domestic constraints, even as they fight off challenges to their leadership, Olmert from within his coalition and Abbas from outside of his coalition. On the second question of the legitimacy of Fatah when Hamas becomes the democratic majority, again, we don't deal specifically with this in the book. Again, I will take off the one hat and put on the other hat. Our policy, U.S. policy vis-a-vis Hamas, has been about as inconsistent as we've seen over the years. The United States was a prime actor in pushing for Palestinian elections in 2006, and when those elections took place and resulted in a free and democratic choice, we didn't accept the results of those elections and imposed conditions which made it, in a sense, turn the process on its head. We imposed conditions on a party in the elections rather than on the Palestinian Authority. It's a different discussion, but it tells you that short-term thinking in this regard probably exacerbated a part of our problem. In June 2007, however, Hamas, which could have had a legitimate argument until then of being the legitimate governing body within Palestine, effected a coup within Palestinian society and in some ways took itself out of the game. So bouncing around, our policy then adjusted to that by focusing entirely on the remaining legitimacy of the Palestinian Authority. This doesn't tell us much about the future other than to go back to what we do cover in the book, which is to be very careful with regard to this question of dialogue. It behooves the United States, we believe, to maintain as open a position as possible with respect to dialogue partners. When we choose not to dialogue with someone, we ought to not build such a high wall around that policy so as to never open up a chance to change things as circumstances might allow.
Let me just say in brief, we encourage our diplomats, American diplomats, to be aware and to be attentive to domestic trends in the region, but don't get overly bogged down in it. Don't get overly involved. And in one particular case, in the case of Israel, and here it's quite different. Palestinians, neighboring Arab states, have different expectations and histories with us, but in the case of Israel, no Israeli leader can withstand turbulence with the U.S. A sound, warm, solid relationship where there's not a lot of light between an Israeli leader and an American administration has become, if it wasn't in the past, it's become now set in stone. It's part of the Israeli political lexicon. I'm not saying it here. It was told to us also in the group. And our diplomats have to be, and our leaders, our elected leaders, also have to be aware of that. And it's something to use. It's part of our, you know, it's I don't know if it's the ace in our pocket, but it's one of our sources of influence, and it can be used positively.
Ian, I'll just address the regional neighbors. There was one last question. We do note the importance to which the Bush 41 administration attached to the regional context of negotiations. That was one of the prime motivations for creating the multilateral track. And we also note with some dismay that the multilateral track and the economic summit track, which was created by the Clinton administration, both faded away in the mid-1990s. In closing this analysis, we note that twice in the last 5 years, the Arab world has articulated a position which is fundamentally different from anything else they had done earlier in the Arab Initiative. And both in 2002 and in 2007, the responsiveness of the United States has been underwhelming. And our suggestion, therefore, would be that it is important to create a regional context that's supportive of peacemaking. We don't particularly say do it X way or Y way, but especially if you have an Arab world coalescing around positions that are favorable to peacemaking, it seems to be an opportunity that should be exploited by the United States in constructing a viable peace process.
Okay, we have about 15 minutes left and four questioners, so we'll take those in two and two, and I want to make sure we leave a little bit of time for our speakers if they have any concluding comments after that.
Hi, Jonathan Coley from the Century Foundation. Thank you, gentlemen, for your book. There's two of you, so if you permit me, two questions. One, perhaps directed at Scott, you mentioned a few times the need for a dynamic policy, and yet I see the opposite occurring, especially over the past few months. The word I keep coming back to is the predictability of events on the ground and also the predictability of the responses and the policy responses from all the respective capitals. Let me be a bit provocative and ask, is it time now for a game-changing event or policy injection? And is that something that the US might want to inject into the debate? And again, let me be even more provocative and suggest, how about getting the UN, which already basically runs the health services, the education services, and the food services, much of it, in the Gaza Strip? Why don't we get the UN in a more robust capacity into the Gaza Strip? And then, Ambassador, a question to you. Again, as the events of the last few months have indicated, the best laid plans of diplomats are always superseded and overridden by violence and violent policies from both sides. So how can the US violence-proof any peace process? Is there anything that the US can add to that goal, or is that fool's gold? Thank you.
Great question. Hi, I'm Rafi Danziger from APAC, and my question is with regard to the role of the top leader. Because if we go back to the 70s, we had President Sadat, who persuaded the Israelis both that he truly wants to make peace with Israel and that he's strong enough to deliver peace. And then the Israelis went ahead and gave up, as you know, every last inch of the Sinai. Then the Palestinians had Arafat, who was clearly strong enough to deliver most of the time, but the Israelis were not persuaded that he was willing to actually make real peace with Israel, so it did not work. And now there's a Palestinian leader who most Israelis, or many Israelis, believe has good intentions, but is seen as very weak and does not even control the entire Palestinian population. The question is, how is it possible to deal with that situation? And again, I want to remind you that, as Tom Friedman said, in the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car, and the idea being that it has to come from inside. It cannot really force people to do things. They have to themselves take ownership. So how do you deal with the problem of top leadership?
Yeah. They're all excellent questions. Is now the right time for a paradigm shifting or major initiative? What we talk about in the book is that when you're going to do that, and you can maybe make a case, it's obviously not an ideal time in terms of how the timeline of administrations. We say very clearly, last year in office isn't the time to do it. But if you're going to do it, there's some things you got to do in advance. One, lining up regional support. Something that wasn't done in Camp David and Clinton administration, as things were getting more turbulent, realized they didn't have a wider fabric to lean on. They called for help in certain Arab capitals, but since they'd all been left out of the room, they weren't there to help. So you do the due diligence, work on the larger structure. Essentially, I'm not going to say yes or no to the question, is it time now or is it not now, but when you're going to do it, you got to work intensively at three levels, the regional level, in the negotiating at the table, and you got to work on the ground, and don't let obstacles on one of those three levels suggest that you should pull back entirely. I was going to say a little bit about the UN case. I mean, the UN is a critical player. The UN is essentially an implementing partner. The UN, I don't think, needs a role, a leading role in diplomacy. Their involvement in the quartet is critical, and they have a lot of assets on the ground. I think the UN, it's important not just on the ground, it's important at the highest level in terms of high politics. It's part of the due diligence in bringing an initiative forward. If you're going to start proposing and bridging and putting your own ideas forward, is to have it enshrined, not just in regional support, in a UN Security Council resolution. I mean, there's a proper role for the UN. Don't get carried away. And there's also something to pay. There's a trend to pay attention to on the Israeli side, which is a tremendous, I wouldn't quite call it a sea change, but a discernible and a growing change in their attitude toward the UN and toward third parties in general. They typically were quite dismissive, and now Israelis, because they're facing so many problems on different fronts, border with Lebanon, border with Gaza, that seem intractable, they're quite open, and that openness can be leveraged.
On the question of, as it was phrased, can the United States violence-proof the peace process, the peace process over the past 30 years is replete with examples of envoys who have found their missions sabotaged by the continuous pursuit of ceasefires. We saw it in the early 1980s, and we see it time and again that a U.S. envoy will go out seeking agreement on principles of a final settlement or whatever the issue du jour is, and some action on the ground sidetracks the envoy's activity to such a point that the envoy uses up extraordinary capital for gains that sometimes don't get implemented. We've seen it even recently with the Secretary of State's achievement of the Agreement on Access and Movement in 2005. The fact that that agreement required a Secretary of State to have it be reached tells us something about the differences between the parties, but it has never really been implemented, which also tells you that it gives you another example of an envoy that gets sidetracked into issues that over which we have no control. Does that mean that there's no answer to this question? I would suggest that there are answers. Number one, monitoring, accountability, and consequences don't necessarily make a process violence-proof, but they bring out in a transparent way what the parties have promised to do quietly and then don't do. And neither the Israelis, nor the Palestinians, nor the Syrians, nor the Lebanese will want over an extended period of time to be known as the party violating commitments that they had made, either to themselves, to each other, or to the United States. If you don't have a monitoring capability, and if you don't have a process by which first quietly and then perhaps in a public way bring some consequences to bear on the party that violates an agreement, you have this constant undermining of commitments, and that erodes the process. A second way is to accelerate your endgame negotiations. There is nothing more successful than success. And in this case, if the two leaders, even with the barrage of Qassam rockets, and even with the counterterrorism policies, and even with the tragic deaths on both sides, if the two leaders can show their publics that there is a structure of an agreement that is sound and reasonable and fair, that will send a very powerful message to those who are trying to use violence to undermine the process. Third factor to deal with this violence-proofing the peace process is incentives as well as sticks. I was just at a conference in Doha where there was a little chiding of Arab states going on because the extraordinary wealth that's accruing as a result of gas and oil prices is not being translated into any assistance at all to Palestinians. Now, it may be that the United States, for our domestic political reasons, does not want to provide assistance to Palestinians in Gaza right now, and that's a different argument. Even if you put that aside, why isn't that gap being filled by the Arab world to at least let Palestinians live better and not have to suffer the consequences of what Hamas is perpetrating and what Israeli counterterrorism policies are also having an effect? So It's not that the United States can deus ex machina decide that we're going to violence-proof the process, and it's very advisable not to get sidetracked into trying to do that. But there are a variety of methodologies that can actually make the process work. I'd also want to address Rafi's question about the role of the top leader, and I think he's exactly right. The peace processes in the Middle East that have been successful have involved very active, energetic approaches by the United States, but they have rested on a fundamental decision by leaders in the region who want to make peace or who want to reach an agreement. I would submit that you have that condition in place right now. Ehud Olmert ran on a platform of deciding either through agreement or unilaterally what the borders of Israel will be, and so the Israeli public elected him knowing that this was what he was going to try to do. And Mahmoud Abbas has made clear since his election in 2005 that he wants to reach an agreement with Israel. Do they have the capability and the strength and the will and the determination to see it through? I don't know. But I think the United States can help test that through a much more energetic, active, and involved policy of our own.
Okay, we have 5 minutes left and two questions. I'd like to ask our final questioners to keep their questions as short as possible, please, and ask our speakers to, in your answers, go ahead and incorporate any concluding remarks you might have so we can finish up on time. Thanks very much.
William Newton, Center for Middle Eastern Studies, University of Texas. This may be a terrible question to ask with 5 minutes left, but having spent some time in the region this past summer, the sort of elephant in the room in any conversation with both the Israeli and the Palestinian side was America's presence in Iraq. And not just in terms of our operations in Iraq, but in terms of our processes, shifting policy, willingness to engage with local actors, savory or not, and a sort of a nuanced understanding of changes in American thought beyond the gross issues of American occupation or military involvement. I wondered if you had any reflections on the ramifications of events in Iraq, both to this point and going forward on the peace process.
Hi, I'm Mike Kraft, counterterrorism consultant, long time in the State Department counterterrorism office. So I asked from that perspective to some extent, because most of the time period you talked about in diplomacy, we're dealing with relatively secular leaders in the Palestinian side. Arafat even renounced terrorism, or some people thought he said tourism, but anyway, he was being more pragmatic. But now we have a situation where you have Hamas and Hezbollah leaders who loudly reject the acceptance of Israel. You've had a change in technology, so to speak, with the introduction of large numbers of rockets, and with countries like Egypt seemingly turning a blind eye on the smuggling of rockets into Gaza and the flow of rockets into Syria. Are there any lessons from the past you think can be useful in trying to deal with this sort of big shift in the cultural attitudes, and can the U.S. do anything to try to damp down the incentive to violence, and also try to get a broader regional approach in terms of, you know, getting the good cops? And finally, Dan, you mentioned not locking ourselves in on the attitudes towards people. You know, a lot of legislation does have waivers. I know when I was in State Department, we fought to get a lot of waivers in there. So there is sometimes more flexibility than appears on the surface. But what quite often happens is this legislation comes in reaction to the terrorist attacks, et cetera, and that's a domestic thing that has to be brought into mind also. Thank you.
Yeah, on the Iraq question, it is far too large to deal with today, but we are in the institute which gave birth to the Iraq Study Group report, which talks at some length about not the dependency of the resolution of one issue on the other, but the fact that in needing to deal both with the Iraq issue and with the Middle East peace process, the United States has to do a better job, because what we do in one affects the other. I'm on public record in an op-ed calling for a timetable for withdrawal with very significant diplomacy in the interim period between that timetable and the actual withdrawal. And I think that what the gentleman from Texas heard this summer is probably an accurate reflection of many attitudes within the region, particularly on the so-called Arab Street, which sees the U.S. Approach in Iraq both as detrimental to the prospects for peace, but also as a sign of some incompetence on the part of the United States to carry forward even what we articulated as our policy. So I think there are ways to deal with this. It may not be possible to deal with it in this administration, given the determination to pursue a certain policy course, but it doesn't mean that it can't be fixed by better policy and better implementation in the future. Do you want to deal with Mike?
Yeah, Mike asked a great question. I mean, fundamentally, part of our role, and some administrations have understood it better than others, part of our role is to insulate leaders and provide incentives for them to take risks for peace. There's all kinds of things that we have in our arsenal. Do we have the same kind of incentives against violence? I mean, our role is to try to empower and to strengthen those who are willing to take risks. And when we've done it, I think we've been successful. Fundamentally, and most definitely with Israelis and Palestinians, but it affects the Israeli-Arab dimension more broadly. These parties can't get what they need from each other. I mean, it's like a truth. So the conflict, going back to when Kissinger and Nixon, I think, gave birth to an active American role. They need to get things from the U.S., each of them, different things, that we can provide to compensate. And that's what we have to do. And we have to always sort of keep that in mind. And then I guess I'll add maybe a very modest plug for the book. There's a lot of books being published on this issue. A lot have been published. And what you'll find, this is not a memoir, and this isn't a book that sort of boils everything down to, let's say, the heroic Shakespearean drama of peacemaking or to domestic politics. We treat all these issues, I think, in ways that they should be treated, which is that they're all part of the mix, and there's really quite a mix. And, you know, sitting here, as Dan said, in an institution that helped to support and produce the Iraq Study Group report, we also tried to produce a document here that can get wide leadership. And, you know, we did it at a place that creates, as I like to say, creates a little safe space in Washington on an issue that's very hard to debate, and not allow polemics to intrude. So, and I want to thank everyone for coming today. Thank you.
Well, before we conclude formally, I would just like to remind everyone that this very important tool, more than a book, is available for sale in the front lobby, as is a copy of the USIP press catalog. So please feel free to drop by on your way out. Thanks very much for coming. Thank you.